Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming. Today we have Jeff Hardin, who is from Sacramento Insight, and he's one of a team of mentor teachers there, and he's also a participant in the Spirit Rock Community Dharma Leader program, so we're both leaders in training. And he's also a board member of the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies and a co-founder of Insight World Aid, and also in his spare time an emergency room physician. Along with other things, right? So I'm really grateful to have Jeff here for the day. Just some logistical things. Bathrooms are just outside this door down the hall, just to the right of the entrance door that you came in. There's hot water and tea in, there's a little alcove here. If you go down the hall and make a left, you'll see a little room there. And there's hot water and tea. And we'll be breaking for lunch at some point, and we can, there's a microwave in there where we can warm things up. And if there's any other questions during the day, feel free to ask me. I'm Lori Wong, and I lead the Insight Meditation Modesto group here. So I will turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you, Lori. Well, it's really great to be here. I'm very grateful for you inviting me and for all of you to come out today on a beautiful Saturday. I know there's a lot of things, other things you could be doing, so it really warms my heart to see that you're interested in practice and sharing your experience and learning about service and Dharma practice with that. So it's really great to be here. I thought we'd maybe just start going around saying our names. We're a fairly small, intimate group, and I think that's a nice way to start these day-longs. So I'm Jeff.
I'm Lori.
Claudia.
Arlene.
Julie.
Stan.
I'm Holly Gray.
Ann.
Karen.
I'm Paul.
I'm Lori.
Jan.
Rose.
Bill.
Gail.
Sue.
I'm Erin.
Great. Thank you. So I thought I'd like to just give an overview of what we're going to do today and kind of give you the schedule, and then we'll start on the first section. There'll be a combination of talking, and I have some material, but you know, we don't have to stick to it, and certainly if our discussions bring us in different directions, I'm open to that, and I really want this to be an interactive day. Not just me up here spouting my opinions, but everyone kind of sharing their experiences with the material. And, you know, if there's any questions you have or comments you'd like to make, please feel free at any time to do that. We'll have some guided meditation, so maybe that's not a good time to chime in. There is a handout that Lori's giving out. It's not something we're going to be reading off. It's just some general information about today's topic and some resources. And I also brought some of my favorite books about service and the Brahma Viharas, which we'll be talking about. So the topic is service as a meditative practice. And I've been interested in this topic for a few years now. Been interested in service my whole life, but you know, I've really reframed a lot what that word means and what it means to do service as I've started a meditation practice and been practicing the Dharma. So a lot has shifted, and then in the last couple of years I've gotten involved with some service organizations and with all of the politics and economic issues and you know the the real life issues that come up with working with others and trying to make some changes or do something significant. You know, it brings up a lot of, frankly, my defilements, you know, from a psychological point of view, my issues, and from a Buddhist point of view, the defilements. So it's been a real furtive area of investigation, and I'm sure everyone here has been involved in service and has looked at that at varying degrees in terms of their practice and what it means, and you know how we are effective and how we get stuck. So I've started introducing this into my Dharma talks, and this is the first day long I've given on the topic, but I've been doing a lot of studying on it and reflecting on it. So basically we'll have several segments. We'll first go into a general discussion of the Brahma Viharas, which I think is a real good foundation. And I'll explain what that word means, you know, for those of you who might be new to some of the terminology, as a foundation for working with others or bringing the Dharma, our Dharma practice out into the world. And then we'll have some periods of walking. We'll have some guided meditations throughout the day. Of metta practice and compassion practice, and there will be, I think, four different discussion sections like this. Where I'll talk about some material, and you know, we can kind of share and some ideas off of each other, and see what we come up with. And I know there's some people that need to leave at lunch, and that, you know, there's no problem. There's no, you know, offense. Feel free to take care of yourself however you need be. I think everyone knows where the bathrooms are, and we've gone over that. So I'll just kind of state to begin with this topic of the Brahma Viharas. That means in Pali, one of the definitions, I'll go into some more depth about this, is the divine abodes. This is metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And I know some of you have worked with that a lot, and it's taught on meditation retreats. You know, I know you've taught metta practice, loving kindness practice, and others. And I really think that's an important foundation to connect with the heart before we actually start working in the world and interacting with others, and particularly as a balance to insight practice, which can sometimes be, I feel Pransdale say that, you know, there's this popular cliche that self-knowledge is not usually good news. I don't know if that's true. I mean, a lot of times what we learn through insight meditation is painful truths, but I think it relieves our suffering, or it gives us new tools to work with our suffering and our conditioning and how we get stuck. And so ultimately, that I think that's good news, but in the beginning it can be quite painful, and in all of the processes that we go through, sometimes the vipassana can be quite heady, you know, or maybe that's not the right word, but quite intense. And so the Brahma Viharas has been traditionally taught as a complement to that, to bring up the positive qualities of the mind and joy. And one thing I wanted to say that maybe was obvious from Lori's introduction, I'm not a Buddhist scholar or an expert in Pali, or, you know, I'm just like everyone here, a Dharma practitioner. So maybe I thought we would just start with an open question of what people have worked with the Brahma Viharas or Metta. You know, what does this mean to you? Or maybe you could share some of your experience with that practice, or maybe some people might have, you know, regular metta practice or other Brahma Viharas, or not, or maybe some people have gone on retreats. So anyone want to say anything about how they feel about the Brahma Viharas?
Generosity, giving without judging, what are they going to do with this money or what have you. Just trying to have an open mind and hopeful that they will overcome whatever obstacle they're experiencing.
Thank you.
I'm new at this, but I've done a class with Rory's a couple of times. I've been trying at home practice, and I do already see a big difference in my life. I probably didn't get because I get better at it. I'm looking forward to know more about it and practice more.
Great. Thank you.
It feels good. It's a good feeling to me.
That's great. Thank you.
I think practicing method is a practical way of learning to open your heart and let love in. I mean, we always say and use the word love, 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 and sometimes our actions and our words don't match. And learning to have an open heart, to be kind, to be compassionate with self as well as others, it's a mind opener as well as a heart opener.
Beautiful.
Okay. Well, I think I've discovered that with metta is not just helping others, but serving others, because we all have our challenges in life and difficulties, and it's sometimes we can get caught up in thinking that I'm okay and they're not and I'm going to help them, when in fact we're helping each other. I mean, we all are teachers at one time or another, whatever we do. So it's basically opening our hearts and reaching out.
That's great. Thanks.
There's a Tibetan practice that I'm thinking of I don't do for myself yet, that I, because I have my own defilements in terms of not thinking I'm worthy and that kind of thing sometimes. But what I really try to do is really be open to people and to just really be with them. And a practice that helps me do that is what's called Tonglen Tibetan practice, where you basically look at the person, the homeless person in particular, and really take in their pain and breathe it in. And then breathe out to them, whatever it is that they need, but especially loving kindness for that, for starters. And that seems to help me, and hopefully it helps them too.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Now we need to use a breathe.
That's great. So if you at any point want to, anyone else want to add something to that, feel free. I'll go on with kind of the definition of the Brahma Viharas in a little more detail and go through each of them individually. And then, as I mentioned, we'll have a guided loving kindness practice in the morning, and in the afternoon we'll have a type of a compassion practice I learned from Bhikkhu Bodhi that's I find very challenging, but really maybe transforming, I guess, is the word. It's very, but we'll see what you'd say, what you think about it. So the word term Brahma Viharas comes from two Pali terms, the ancient language of the Buddha, Brahma meaning God or godlike. Sometimes that's translated as divine. And then Vihara, which means abode or home. It can also mean monastery. And so what these are dwelling places of the gods, or where somebody who had a, let's say, the attitude, the disposition, the positive, skillful qualities of a divine being. You know, this is all a Buddhist concept. We believe the Brahma Viharas predated the Buddha, and he turned them, like many things, into fit into the Dharma and the teachings of Dharma practice, and so it kind of changed that, but maybe nobody really knows, since nothing was written down in those days. It was off an oral tradition. But some other synonyms for Brahma would be excellent or superior or unlimitless, unbounded, sublime. You might hear different combinations of these. And I like Sharon Salzberg translated as Brahma is best and Vihara is home, so it's our best home. And she says that, you know, like any home, sometimes we're not there, you know, we go out, but we have a place to come back to that we know is, you know, safe, and that's really, you know, where we can be. In the Buddhist philosophy, it's believed that people who are fully enlightened are constantly dwelling in the Brahma-viharas. They're always, their mind is not reactive like ours are, but in that state. And Aya Kema, I wasn't practicing when she was alive, but I've listened to a lot of her talks and studied with Lee Brasington, who's one of her, who's her senior student. She calls the divine abodes the only wholesome emotions. You know, it's kind of tricky to take Buddhist psychology with different terminology and apply it to our Western language. So I don't know if emotion quite fits, but basically what she's saying is that any emotion we have that is not one of these four areas is, you know, based on clinging, and therefore has some unwholesomeness to its root. It's kind of a challenging statement, but I'll leave that with you. So what these are, they're, as I mentioned, positive states of mind that can be intentionally cultivated as meditation practices, and was taught by the Buddha and his followers, and has been, like everything else from we know about the Dharma, transmitted through these 2,600 years now, so that we have it as practices available for us. And they're really meant to open the mind and the heart and to counteract the unwholesome roots, the defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. We'll talk, I'm going to read a few sutta passages, and we'll talk a little bit more about how they were taught in the suttas and later, but that's basically what they were, as far as I can tell, meant as. And as I mentioned earlier, I see them as really as a balance to some of the painful insights that we can get in Dharma practice, a way to open our hearts. You know, sometimes it's spoken of as the two wings of Dharma practice, compassion and wisdom. And so we need kind of a balance of that, I think, or at least I have needed that. With cultivation of the Brahma-viharas, they become a natural inclination of the heart. So, and I've seen that, for example, with driving. And remember, you know, times in my life, I'm embarrassed to say, I've been involved in road rage. You know, things have escalated, and I'm really angry, and, you know, whether I acted out on that or just seethed in that fury, it's just, you know, really toxic experience. And so with specifically metta practice and, you know, understanding, you know, the roots of suffering, in my mind and body, I've really been able to change my framework, my orientation when driving. And so if something happens, I'm cut off. Sometimes there'll be a little, you know, commentary, like, jerk. But it's amazing how it's changed. I mean, that might sound like a small triumph, but it's really great for me. You know? And certainly in my job in the ER, I have a lot of reactivity. And you know, before I really had a solid practice, you know, I was quite burnt out and quite toxic at the job, and unkind quite often. And over the years, it's been really heartwarming for me that some of my colleagues have commented, you know, you really changed, you know, over the years. One person said, you know, you used to be an asshole. and you know, I took that as good news. You know, not that I was, you know, a certain way, but that they have seen a change and that they don't consider me bad anymore. You know, that there has been some, at least external and I think internal, changes. So the ultimate, in the suttas, I think the ultimate goal of the Brahma-viharas and all of the Dharma is to uproot the defilements and to transform the heart, to have being insight into the three characteristics of anatta, of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, so of impermanence, you know, and suffering, and the, say, not self or the substancelessness of our existence. That's a little bit beyond the scope of what I'm talking about today, but basically is to become liberated, to become awakened, is how we've traditionally been taught. And I think they're very practical that we can use them. So I'd like to give the kind of the stock, read the stock passage in the suttas that, of how the Buddha and his main disciples taught the Brahma Viharas. You know, it's a short phrase that's repeated over and over again in many suttas. And this goes, it goes like this. One abides having suffused with the mind of loving kindness in one direction of the world, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, and so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to oneself, one abides suffusing the entire universe with loving kindness. With a mind grown great, lofty, boundless, and free from enmity and ill will. So that's the stock phrase for loving kindness, and then the same thing is repeated for compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And we see this over again in the suttas. In fact, we don't see a loving kindness. It's mentioned in a few other places in a different terminology. So that's quite a mouthful. but you get the sense that you know, whatever this quality of loving kindness is, and we'll go more into that, that we're supposed to not just have it for ourselves, but to have it for others and equally throughout the world, and that we can, I don't know if they use the word radiating, but that's, you know, some translations that you radiate loving kindness, which I think sounds pretty neat, you know, rather radiating, you know, harsh speech or unskillful actions, to radiate loving kindness in all of our interactions. That's really, that'd be really a powerful transformation. There are other passages that give the Brahma Viharas in particular context where the Buddha was teaching it, or Sariputta, or one of the other disciples, and they're particularly is taught to people on their deathbed. And I'm told that in Asia, it's still oftentimes people will recite the Metta Sutta or some other aspect of loving kindness or other Brahma Viharas as somebody is dying or after they've died. It was also taught as a way to be reborn in heaven. You know, there's this whole Buddhist cosmology of rebirth and, you know, being reborn into different realms. And so there's images in the suttas where the Buddha would teach this I'm thinking of one particular passage in the Majjhima Nikaya, I think 97, where Sariputta is teaching it to somebody who is dying, you know, because that person wants to be, you know, basically born into a better station in the next life and wants to be born in the Brahma world. And so Sariputta gives these teachings, you know, gives that same phrase that we just read to this person who's dying, and, you know, basically says, practice with this, you know, until your last breath. And then that person dies, and Sariputta goes back to the Buddha, who lightly admonishes him for not giving him additional teachings to bring him to full liberation. So that's a kind of an interesting little passage that, you know, kind of suggests that. And scholars over the years have really made a lot of this. And I don't want to get us too sidetracked, that, you know, the Brahma Viharas are not the end goal of the practice. To be reborn at a favorable birth is not the ultimate goal of Dharma practice. And then it was also taught as a protection for the monks in particular from ill will or ill treatment from others. And as far as I can tell, it wasn't taught as, you know, maybe we might conceptualize it in a Judeo-Christian fashion as, you know, like a charm or a prayer to protect us, but more as a internal meditative state to protect one's own mind from ill will. That, you know, we don't have control over how other people are going to act, but we can have, you know, with practice, some control over our own minds and, you know, how we're how what we're thinking and saying and doing. this is really, I think, pretty starkly portrayed in this passage that I like from the also from the Majjhima Nikaya, number 21, the simile of the saw. I don't know if any of you have read this before. I just have a little short passage I'll read. But the context of this sutta is the Buddha's with some monks. And, I mean, like a lot of suttas, there's several different things going on. But one part is he's teaching the monks how to have an equanimity around whether people are saying pleasant things or giving you compliments, praise, or whether they're saying harsh and unfavorable things to you, how to have a certain equanimity about that. And, you know, he's teaching them not to get kind of pulled in either direction, but to have a balance. And so he comes up with this simile or this analogy that I think really captures this idea that I was expressing. So he says, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, pretty harsh. One who gives rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. You should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That's a pretty high bar. I don't know if anyone wants to make a comment on that. I'm not there, but it is something inspiring to think. Well, that would be a goal maybe for me, you know, rather than being on the, you know, on the highway and coming up with these, you know, all this anger and hostility for someone, but to, you know, when someone steps on my toe or, you know, even attacks me, if I could have a certain equanimity about that and respond with loving kindness rather than react with hatred or fear.
Well, I have a question about that. I get the mental image of somebody just standing by and letting somebody wipe your limbs off and thinking, well, about
self-protection. Yeah.
I mean, is it a hateful thing to protect yourself?
Well, what do you think? I have an opinion
about it. Huh? I don't think so.
Just you don't think it's to stand by and idly be used as a doormat or abused is not within in line with the teachings, for example. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes.
I'll give Sharon Salzberg's answer. And that is, you know, if you're being accosted, she asked this of Manindra, by the way, and he told her, you know, with all the loving kindness you can muster, hit the person over the head with your umbrella. And you know, this teaching is really challenging. Because it also reminds me of, you know, hearing stories of the Tibetan monks or the Tibetan nuns who have been tortured or, you know, badly treated by the Chinese. And how it's amazing that some of these monks or some of these nuns will say, you know, I was in the most danger when I thought I was going to lose my compassion for the Chinese. And if you really consider that, that's huge, to be being tortured and, you know, offering compassion and thinking compassion and not allowing ill will to even enter the mind is just tremendous. You know, it's like this simile of the saw, someone sawing your arm off, to actually have a state of mind which does not hold any ill will is a very high bar. But I think at some point in the practice you start to realize how much suffering there is and what suffering comes from having ill will in the mind. That it's actually a stronger compulsion to not allow ill will in, because you know what the suffering is like that comes from it, what the pain in the mind is like when you have ill will. You know, it's something to play with, and I, you know, it's something that I work with, you know, driving down the road or doing whatever it is. But to start actually changing the mind to realize, to notice what it feels like when you have anger or ill will in the mind and what that does. You know, it's the noticing the contrast. What would you rather have? If you could choose a mind state, wouldn't you rather have love and joy and compassion in your mind? And equanimity? Or would you rather, you know, sometimes the phrase is, would you rather be happy or right? Right? But if you could only have one, you know, the cost of being right versus having peace of mind and equanimity, you know, when you really look at it, starts to, as you practice more and more and you start to see what the cost is, you begin to realize that it's painful.
And you don't even have to be our age to do it. In Western tradition, of course, there was Anne Frank, who, not alone, but with other fellow inmates in the death camps, was able to see and serve other people even as she was dying. And one of the commentaries, which I've always taken to heart, is on that whole challenge of being, as a Jew, or an unwanted person in the death camps, the Nazi death camps, they can take everything from us. They can take our physical freedom. They can take our lives. But they can't take how we will respond to any situation unless we're that. Or we fall into the trap of blaming or being angry or resentful. We always have that choice, but most of us don't see that. And that's what these teachings are so clear about and give us that choice to do if we want it and practice it.
I think it's nice to have little insights along the way. Just this week, I was thinking about crimes that happen to young people and women and all people, and sometimes the punishments that the courts render out are nowhere near in my mind. They don't fit the crime. And I just started thinking, well, what else would I want to see happen? And I got a glimpse of what I would like to see happen. And it does put you on the same level of, let's say, violence and hatred as the person who committed the crime. And so I had to step back a bit to see what that was about me. You know, I think it takes a long time to be blissful and knowledgeable enough to know that you do have some choice in how you react to something, how you respond to something, but it's something wrong for me. And I have to know that. So I said, here's hope.
Thank you. That's great. Yeah. So, I mean, to answer your question, Bill, my opinion is there's a skillful response in any situation, and we just have to, you know, do the best we can, you know, and just continue to cultivate the mindfulness and the loving kindness, and hope that when we're confronted with these, you know, very challenging, difficult situations, that we'll show up the best we can to them and do it in our skillful way. But yeah, I certainly couldn't stand by and watch someone being abused, for example, and not take some action. And that, you know, I'd like to do it with loving a mind of loving kindness, but in reality, you know, I don't think I'm there either. So
I think of this like I think of my kids, and I think when they do something and they're wild or something, and when I react in anger, maybe they need to be in the room because they just aren't behaving in a way that's appropriate in a different spot. And so I can grab them forcefully and squeeze their arms as I walk them to their room, or I can hold them gently and walk them to their room. In both ways, I'm saying, you have to stop now. But one is from, I'm so mad that you're doing this to me. And so I'm being more, having a punishment in there, like I'm getting revenge in some piece. And the other way, I'm just putting them in their room, you know? And so when I think about that, and I think about that with everybody, like when I have something that's being done to me, or something that's, you know, not working out for whatever reason, something's hurting me or whatever, I can say, you know, stop that, I don't like it, and defend myself in a way that's just keeping myself safe. Or I can say, ooh, and I'm going to get you back, and there's the piece that wants to make it squeeze their arms just a little hard to know, you know what I mean? And like, it's that little difference of softly holding their arms and taking them to their room and saying, this is my boundary, and squeezing their arms and saying, this is my boundary and you're going to hurt too, you know? And for me, that's the difference. And so I just think of that in my life. And am I squeezing their arms, or am I just putting them in their room, you know, with everything?
Yeah. Wonderful.
Because it's a different feeling. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it feels different to the recipient, too.
Right.
You know, I remember as a child getting both treatments and,
right.
and really being very fearful and, you know, upset about what, you know, the anger response, and being, you know, kind of more contained and more allowing me to, you know, really experience the consequence of my actions.
Right.
You know, so it's a really, it's very powerful. So just a little bit more here. The suttas don't really give specific instructions. I think a lot of us have had specific instructions, and I'll give some specific instructions on how to do these Brahma-Vihara practices, especially metta, which is the foundation. And really, our modern practice of loving-kindness comes down from the Vasuddhimagga, which is treatise, really. It's called The Path of Purification, written by Buddhaghosa about 1,000 years after the Buddha's death. And he wrote this tome. It's, I don't know if a number of you have the book. It's a very thick, dense book that a lot of our practices come down from, you know, some of the Vipassana we do. And it's, you know, supposedly the Sangha at the time, their best wisdom of what survived from the Buddha and how to skillfully work with it. So there's some specific practices in chapter 9 of this book. It's, you know, several dozen pages of Brahma-Vihara work. And it's pretty interesting. You know, in general, it's a bit dry, the Vasuddhimagga, but the chapter on the Brahma-Viharas is kind of interesting to see. Oh, well, that's where that comes from, you know. For example, the list of people that we say metta towards, you know, directly from there. And one thing that's real interesting is this riddle that I came across, and I've heard this in other contexts, but it's from this book, this writing. And basically it has to do with, you know, the Brahma-Viharas, and you're given this scenario where, kind of getting back to the gruesomeness of the simile of the sa, you have a bandit there. There's a lot of bandits in the suttas, or a few. And the bandit says to you, okay, we need one person to kill. And so there's you, there is a dear person to you, someone, you know, who you love very dearly. A person who's neutral. Sometimes we think of, you know, like our postal person or someone in the shop, someone we know but we're kind of neutral about. And then somebody who's difficult or challenging. Sometimes we use the word the enemy. But, you know, it's kind of a hostile person, but somebody who's a real challenge for us. So you have those four people, and you've got to choose which one to give the bandits to kill. Any takers?
Do you have to choose?
Well, I think, yeah. I think we have to choose in all situations. I mean, so your choice would be
Yeah, can I say I don't choose?
Okay. All right. Dale, you had some.
What about giving yourself?
Yeah. Can give oneself? Okay. That yeah, that's one of the four, is to give yourself. Anyone else give themselves to the bandits?
Give myself first so I wouldn't have to choose.
That's good. You can combine those. So, well, the answer is probably a little different worded, but that by choosing one of those, even yourself, you're showing a preference or an exclusion of that person. So the traditional answer in the Visuddhimagga, and I'm not saying this is, you know, comes from the Buddha's lips, I'm just saying this is what is given in this text, is that you know, if you've really practiced these to the refinement that they're meant to be, you would not be able to make a choice that all beings are, you know, that yourself and the most difficult person are equal, or, you know, and that one does not deserve love or death any more than the other does. So that was that answer.
So the bandit would have to choose.
Right. Yeah. Again, let's hope we don't ever get to that. Get that choice in real life. And what the phrasing they use in the Visuddhimagga is breaking down the barriers between us and others, or between, you know, our loved one and a stranger, and that the power of doing that is really, you know, of generating loving kindness and these other qualities to that point. Is that we don't have, when we have a choice or we do a comparison like that, there's a little, sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's very gross, ill will and greed. So there's these defilements that help us make those choices. Again, it's, you know, hard for me to really be there if I had to choose between my loved ones, you know, and someone I didn't know. It'd be hard pressed for me to say, oh, you know, take your pick. Take me. Maybe I would say that, but, you know, that would not be keeping with these traditional teachings. So, briefly, I'd like to go through the four ones in a little bit more depth before we finish. So, metta is translated as loving kindness, loving friendliness. Some people translate it as love. Thanissara Bhikkhu translated as goodwill. And it's the mind and the heart's inclination towards goodwill, towards oneself and others, of wishing them well, of wishing them, you know, happiness and health. It's a positive regard, again, without the exclusion or preference, when it's you know, ideally practiced. And it's different from the term we use, oftentimes it's different from the term we use, love, in our culture, you know, which oftentimes has a lot of clinging at it, you know, and preference and exclusion to it, and conditions oftentimes with our love. You know, someone has to be a certain way in order for us to, you know, fully love them. It's a common problem I think we encounter. The metta is really the foundation of the other Brahma Viharas, and, you know, it's they're taught in sequence because metta is supposedly easier for us to take to. There's the Metta Sutta, which I know many of you know, this is one of the most beloved and certainly the most recited of the Buddhist discourses throughout the world. It's always being chanted at a lot of monasteries, a lot of retreats we take, and it's very beautiful sutta. I gave a whole day long on the Metta Sutta at our Sangha in Sacramento in December, and if you're interested in knowing more about that, there's the audio talks from that day long and a handout about it. And then I think on today's handout, there's a reference to Andrew Alinsky's. He's got a whole study guide on that. And that is just a really, you know, it's a like 60 pages, so it's not just like a half-hour read. It's a real year-long practice of the Metta Sutta and the qualities that are taught by the Buddha with Metta, that are available in a PDF, you know, in a reading format. I don't think there's audio files associated with that. And then he has some very concrete practices on how to cultivate Metta in so many different scenarios in our daily lives. It's a very great resource if you're interested in that kind of thing. The Metta Sutta and the commentaries was the legend is was taught as an antidote that was given by the Buddha for some of his monks who had gone to inhabit an area, and there were these tree spirits that were making a hard time for them. You know, they would have to stay put for the rains period and do intensive practice, much like our long-term retreats today. And they went to this one area, and these tree spirits didn't like all these monks, you know, hanging out all this time, so they made these terrible noises and smells and sounds and sights, and so that, you know, really disturbed the peace and tranquility of meditation. So they went running back to the Buddha, and the Buddha, you know, and they said, oh, come on, give us another place to go. That place is haunted, you know. And the Buddha said, you know, he kind of, as he does in a lot of these sutras, looked out throughout the land with his mind's eye and said, you know, that's actually the best place for you to go. But, you know, fear not, I'll give you something that will protect you. So he taught them this Metta Sutta, and the legend goes that they went back to that place and they were reciting this, and it opened up the hearts of the tree spirits that were assailing them, and they welcomed them with loving arms. That's how the story ends. I won't go through the whole sutta, but there's one, getting back to this breaking down the barriers and what you were talking about being a parent. There's this one image from that sutta that's very powerful that describes metta, and that I'm trying to say it. It's talking about having loving kindness as a mother would have love towards her child, her only child, and so if we can radiate that outward with the same, you know, affection and concern that we have for a child. Now, I think, you know, this my experience has been with, you know, the kind of love for children and for parents and for loved ones. Sometimes it's a little tainted with a little bit of clinging, you know, obviously if somebody came, you know, and I think this is appropriate, if someone came for your child, you know, you would protect them, you know, because who else will do that? But that's, again, an example of breaking down the barriers. And it also points to the fact that in Buddhist cosmology with rebirth, that we've all been each other's brothers and sisters and mothers and child, and, you know, we've had all these different roles. You know, you don't have to believe that, and, you know, I'm still working on it, but the teaching there is that, you know, that's one basis of this breaking down the barriers. In the loving kindness practice, we have like a traditional formula that we use these certain phrases, which we'll do in the guided meditation, and then we have categories of people, and we always start with ourself. I think that's really powerful and important in maybe all cultures, but certainly in our cultures, where there's so many voices, internal voices of self denial and self criticism. You're speaking about that, Stan, and I think we all have that. And so it's really important, if we can't get beyond ourselves and having loving kindness for ourselves, it's just so watered down and so convoluted, I think. That's been my experience when we try and have it for others. So it's really important to start with that. And when I first started the loving kindness practice, I quickly learned I couldn't go on to the other categories. I was so stuck with, you know, so much, you know, self... so much self-hatred, really, that it was skillful for me just to stay with myself as the recipient of it, you know, for years, you know, for a few years. And then, you know, once that healing took place, I'm able now to have the loving kindness for others. So that's the traditional formula. We'll do that in a little bit. But there's also other... that doesn't work for a lot of people. Some people struggle with that. So there's other types of doing it. You mentioned Tong Lin, which is a visualization, a Tibetan visualization metta practice. There's also some of the teachers, Ajahn Brahm, I know you sometimes teach him. He's got this one that really, you know, moved me, where he has a visualization of taking a wretched little kitty or a baby that you find, you know, abandoned, cold, wet, hungry, you know, shivering, trembling with fear, and then you take it to your, you know, your chest and you warm it up and you say the phrases or think loving kindness for that, and you know, the cat or the dog or the child, you know, starts to, you know, the body starts to relax and you can feel that, and they, you know, maybe the cat, it starts to purr, you know, you can imagine yourself cleaning the fur off or, you know, warming the child or, you know, however you want to do it. So there's a visualization practices that really are helpful. And with all of these, it's not just these phrases or an intellectual exercises, but it really is, as I mentioned, this term emotions. It's a feeling. We're really trying to connect our heart with the practice. It's sensations in the body, in the breath, and in the heart, really, that we're cultivating. So that's why that particular visualization is... has been helpful for me. And then Ayakema has a number, you know, like four or five different guided imagery visualizations like that. There's a website for those of you who like her stuff. Many of her Dharma talks are available. I think it's called ayakematalks.org, but they've put them in MP3 format. It's a wonderful resource. And then also these practices, these Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, are taught as concentration practices. In the Visuddhimagga, it talks about them as really being for the purpose of concentrating the mind, you know, to the level of absorption, the jhanas, and then using that to gain insight, to become liberated. And that's the ultimate goal, according to the traditional teachings. The second Brahma Vihara is Karuna, which is often translated as compassion. Sometimes it's translated as sympathy. And that's really the skillful response of the heart when it encounters suffering. Loving kindness is more of a giving of one's goodwill towards others, and compassion is really how our hearts skillfully respond to in the face of suffering, ours or another's suffering. And there's a, I guess the roots of the word compassion. Passion, I think this is Latin, correct me if anyone knows, I didn't ever study Latin, but passion means suffering, and com means with, so you're suffering with another. You know, and that's similar to another word that's used in the suttas in Pali a lot for compassion is anukampa. Some of you may have heard that, and some there's that's actually a fairly common name in India and Sri Lanka. Beautiful name, but kampa means to tremble or to shake, and anu means with. So it's kind of it signifies the heart trembling with suffering. Again, ours or another's, and that's a nice, I think, an image. And this can, the compassion can come in the form of skillful thoughts we may have of compassion, words, or even actions. And it's really, I think, at the base of, you know, when we get to start talking about service, it really is something that, you know, becomes a very challenging practice to look at that. And it also can be, we'll do a guided compassion meditation this afternoon. The third one is mudita, and this is probably the least talked about, maybe the least practiced of the four Brahma Viharas, but also very important. It's oftentimes translated as joy or sympathetic joy or empathetic joy. Or sometimes it's gladness or appreciative joy. And that's when we take unselfish delight in another's good fortune, their prosperity, their good health. It can also be, there's nothing in the Suttimagga about this or any of the traditional teaching, but I think it can be also, we can have sympathetic joy towards ourselves. And what that might look like is gratitude, you know, just to be very grateful for what we have and to be happy again, it's an emotional content of not just the thoughts of it, but you know what's coming up in the body and the mind. And last is upekkha, which is often translated as equanimity. And this is really, you know, maybe the ultimate expression of the Brahma Viharas. It's really challenging, but it's the ability of the heart and the mind to remain in balance regardless of what's happening, what the circumstances are, to be unattached, to not recoil from what's difficult or to really cling to what's pleasant and what we want, but to just be neutral. And we'll spend quite a bit of time, I hope, discussing this particular aspect in how, you know, sometimes it can go awry into apathy, you know, or indifference. We'll talk more about that. What's that?
Well, or disconnectedness,
yes.
I've found.
Yeah.
So it's a fine line of being in balance and not attached, but yet not almost an aversion, or, yeah, disconnection, I guess.
Yeah. Keeping it at arm's length. And this really points to that when we're faced with suffering, you know, really the goal is not to get sucked into it, you know, or to recoil from it, but to be present for it, to be able to work with it. And then just before we go to I think we're going to do a walking meditation in a minute, I just wanted to give a brief overview of where these Brahma Viharas, where we trip up on them, you know, in the traditional languages, the near and the far enemies of it. And basically these, the near enemy is kind of a look-alike, it mimics it. We're talking about apathy, for example. And the far enemy is just the opposite, you know. So each one of these has those. Again, this is from the Visuddhimagga, and there's a nice table about this in the on Andrew Linsky's website for the Insight Journal. A few years back, he did a table on the Brahma Viharas that gives the traditional formula of their characteristics and their near and far enemies. So that's one resource on their website. And I think it's important to be on the lookout for these because they constantly crop up in my life anyways. So for metta, loving kindness, the near enemy is attachment, and there are many forms of what that could look like. It could be the conditional love we were talking about. I'll love you if you are a certain way. Or to have an expectation on it. Or maybe to use loving kindness as a supplicating prayer, like sometimes we can send out loving kindness because we're really hoping that person will get better, you know, they'll heal or whatever. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but there is, when I do that, and I have done that a lot, there's a clinging in there in my mind with that. And that clinging does create some suffering for me. Passionate love, you know, is a romantic love that's is rooted in sensual desire. So that's another mimic. And then a fear-based love, you know, that that we have to be a certain way or we won't be loved. You know, that's another of the near enemies. And then the far enemies is just plain old ill will or hatred, aversion, fear. That's just the opposite of what loving kindness is. Compassion, the near enemy, would be a pity, you know. Or it could be a lot of things, actually, blaming somebody for their suffering or for their circumstances. There can be a bargaining, you know, or a set of conditions. You know, I want this certain outcome for this person. Certainly we can have that, but, you know, once we cling to that outcome, then that's where we get into trouble. There's a modern term, I think, for the that's really fits well with the near enemy of compassion. That's codependency. And there's different forms of codependency that we, you know, we can enmesh, you know, again, where the suffering of another is so attractive or intensive, or so we want so much to fix it that it just pulls us in, you know, and we just kind of lose our equanimity. Or there could be one of, you know, totally trying to control the situation, you know, knowing we have the answers and we're getting in there. to do it our way. The far enemy of compassion is cruelty. You know, just the opposite of compassion. If we're cruel to another person, or we're wishing for their suffering to increase or remain. Sympathetic joy, the near enemy, is I guess just giddiness or silliness, or just, you know, just being kind of frivolous, maybe exhilarated. And the far enemy is envy. You know, so again, the sympathetic joy is where we have an unselfish interest in another person's well-being. And so the far enemy is that we envy their well-being. We're jealous. We want their success, or we want them to not have their success. That would be the opposite of sympathetic joy. And then for equanimity, as we mentioned, the near enemy is detachment, apathy, and indifference. It can also be superiority. You know, like, I'm better than you are, so therefore it's okay. Or even boredom, you know, with the situation. That would be, those are all near enemies. And the far enemy is just agitation, being totally caught up, clinging, grasping, pushing away something that's difficult, or grasping something that's pleasant. So, before we do our walking meditation, does anyone have a comment or question? Or, yeah.
Is there ever an appropriate time for giddiness and exhilaration? I mean, living one's life without spontaneously feeling, you know, that type of joy or inner feeling.
What do others say?
I think I can speak to that from personal experience, because people who know me, and I know it for myself too, I'm very hyper. And yeah, that can lead easily to being overdoing it. Exhilaration, being so giddy and so much energy and hyperness, that it's not appropriate. And learning when to rein it in, what's focusing.
And I think the real key is the attachment. So sometimes we can get caught in the wanting exhilaration for the sense of the adrenaline or the sense of the energy, as opposed to actually really truly being with the joy of that person's success or well-being. So it doesn't mean that you can't be, you know, happy and joyful for someone's well-being or success or good fortune. But it's when we get attached to that sense of our own excitement.
The rush.
So when we get caught in our own excitement, then we have this difficulty. So it's not that it, you know, we have to be somber. And that's not it. But it's the idea that we don't get caught up within that and get lost, so that we no longer have balance. I think that's the real key, is having the balance.
I think maybe for me, when I'm giddy, it's all up in my head, and when I have joy, it's like more in my heart. Like, I feel the joy and it feels really good, but when I'm giddy, I'm like, hee, and like, I'm I don't know how to say that. And the joy feels actually much better because it's centered and it's calming and it's wonderful. But the giddy is like, hey, and then all of a sudden I'm like, what am I doing? What's going on here? And I'm kind of like spinning away. So it feels good, but it's not the same. I don't know.
Great, well, great comments. I don't know, we can take a vote. We could do a walk, people can walk vote if you wanted, at least in some of the walking periods, to do guided Qigong. That's an option too. Maybe we could have those two options. Certainly use the restrooms. We'll have like a half an hour period now before our guided meditation. And we'll ring the bell.